Wake up with the news and information you can trust. Starting your day the right way with the Andy Griffin Show. This is News Radio 890, 92.5 KDXU.
Hey, good morning to you. 909 on KDXU. I'm Andy Griffin. Thanks for tuning in to the program every first Wednesday of the month. Even with the holiday tomorrow, we hear from Dr. David Blodgett. Hi, Dr. Blodgett, our public health official. How are you?
It's great to be here. Hi.
Appreciate you coming. If you have a question for Dr. Blodgett, I would encourage you to do one of two things. Either call our hotline at 435-673-5890, or you can text me at 435, and then it's 467-5842. And I have found Dr. Blodgett to be a pretty wise man when it comes to all things health. I haven't asked him about, you know, the winner of the Super Bowl back in 1997, but I maybe did ask him about the health of football players or whatever.
I couldn't tell you that.
I have no idea either, 97. I think it was the Cowboys.
Yeah, well, it's interesting because they do a study, you know, there's all the hype, and then they ask people 6 months later who won the national championship this year, and
nobody
like
knows.
70% no. Can't say.
Yeah.
No. So we get all excited in the moment, and then it doesn't mean anything really.
Yeah. And really, it lasts. Most of the championships last until the next season starts, as far as how good you feel.
Right.
The next season starts, and you lose a game or two, and you're like, yeah, I don't feel so good anymore. So.
Well, I mean, there's actually a well-documented effect where you get such a high.
Oh, yeah.
Coming
oh, yeah.
off that high is kind of a problem you have to kind of guard against. Or
I
be aware of it. You
know? Personally relate to that. In fact, I have. It was a process of learning. When I was first married, I was not a very nice person if my favorite team lost.
Right.
And my wife had to slowly educate me that it is not okay to be a jerk just because your team lost.
Yeah, well, you know, there's actually studies where they show that domestic violence rates go up when big games happen, like a tap championship or something.
It's true.
It's interesting that it's even whether your team wins or loses.
Really?
Yeah. So it's just that aggravation of all the emotions and stuff like
that. Man, oh, man. So we do love our sports here in the United States. And it's not just here. It's all over the world. It's just a different
all
sport.
All through the history of the rest world, too, right?
So. Yeah, Canada, it's hockey. And the rest of the world, it's what they call football, which is soccer.
Yeah.
And I think there's like one country, like India or something, that likes lacrosse the best. But everybody else is soccer except the United States and Canada.
Yeah.
So
yeah, lacrosse was big out east, you know. Hopkins was a lacrosse school, but I guess I shouldn't have a little shameless plug.
No, it's okay. Do it.
Experience that around our house. My daughter was on the state champion golf team. I don't know if you
nice.
That, but,
pretty cool.
It's cool.
Cedar High, right?
All that. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. They came from behind at state. It was a lot of fun.
Very cool. Yeah. And you were not in any way a sport parent, heavily involved in that at all, were you? Maybe a little.
It was fun to be part of.
A couple of health notes in the headlines today. Soda additive BVO, brominated vegetable oil, has been banned by the FDA. Now, in doing research on this, you found that most products have stopped using it anyway, right?
Yeah. Well, or they will. So I think it becomes effective August 21st.
Yeah.
So there's actually a complete list of all the products that had it. They're all mostly all sodas and citric sodas. So things like orange and grapefruit.
Mountain Dew used it for a while.
Yeah, so Mountain Dew had it until last year, so they kind of beat the deadline by pulling it out. But there was one variant of Mountain Dew that still had it. But most of them were off-brand kinds of things, like Smith's.
Yeah, generic orange soda or something like that.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's interesting, though, and maybe it's worth talking about some of the processes they have. So there's as many as 5,000 new chemicals that hit the market every year, 5, right?
5,000.
And then they go through this process where initially they say, well, we don't have evidence that there's harm from it if it's going into food. And so we call that generally recognized as safe for grass. But then when they think, well, there might be something wrong here. So this particular product was taken off the grass list in the 70s because they said, well, we want to pay closer attention to this. So then it rises to this level of, well, you know, we're not sure, but to say it isn't is just safe is probably not correct. So then the FDA monitored that. And now finally this year, so 50 years later, they decide, yeah, there are some health effects here and we're going to pull them for the market. So there's just such a huge volume and so much complex interactions and stuff. Yeah. It's really hard to know what it is you're eating in your food sometimes.
So. I think about, so the way it was worded in the article was the FDA has now said they no longer consider it safe. That worries me because I'm like, well, wait a minute, what what made him turn the corner where it was okay, like you said, it came off the grass list, so it was okay still, but they think it might not be good, and now they've decided actually this is kind of bad for you. I don't know how that process works.
Well, there's probably a study. They probably did a specific study that you know, and sometimes it has to be fairly long term. Yeah, I mean, it's really complicated to establish links to health effects from one substance. And so, you know, I have to be careful in how you design the studies. And so then there's.
Yeah. Well, you know, we remember from statistics class. Yeah. Maybe there was something else in it also.
Yeah. You know? Well, yeah. How do you figure out if there's something else there that could be? Yeah. It's complicated, but it's necessary and it's getting more complicated in the world we live in. And so I always consider that, you know, 5,000 chemicals every year. Wow. And you know, some of them have to not be great, and so that's all chemicals. It's not just in food, but it's, you know, cleaners and other products, you know, that gosh, you know, you just don't know where they're at.
I wonder sometimes, and we as Americans, we feel like the FDA is protecting us,
right?
But are there foods out there where the FBI just goes, we think it's okay? I think about the simple Twinkie, right? You got this yellow cake. We don't know what's made, the cake is made out of, and then you've got this weird white cream substance on the inside. There's no way it's whipped cream, because whipped cream is milk, it would go bad. It's some sort of, and I wonder what's in that, and is it okay? The FDA says it's okay, yeah. So I assume
good,
it is.
Good for 30 years, right? So I don't know. I think it fits into the discussion we've had about the closer you get it to being not processed, the better off you probably are. And I think that's a good rule of thumb.
My wife is working on this particular diet where she says if it doesn't have a mother or was grown in a field, then you don't want it.
Yeah.
So I was like, wait a minute, that rules out a lot of stuff. But I'm okay with if it doesn't have the mother part, because I like to smoke meat, you know. So I'm good there. But yeah, it's an interesting diet that she's embarking
on. It's hard, you know. That is a hard diet and difficult for people to achieve, right? It takes you back to the old days of, well, I go to the market every day and I prepare food every day, and there's just not, you know, it doesn't have a shelf life, so.
Can't put it in the freezer, you know, you can't get a freezer meal or.
So I think it's really, I think if we take our more moderate stance that we take in almost everything we do, you say, you know, maybe I can cut some of that out. And I think an obvious target is sodas. You know, the sodas are on this list again somehow. And it adds a lot of calories. There are a lot of, you know, we've talked about the perils of diet sodas too, how they increase appetite, you know, paradoxically. And so I just, you know, maybe pick one target and see, work on getting that down, or just be a little bit less. You know, we're trying to do things in an incremental way rather than. I don't know. I don't know how well it will go if you just say tomorrow I'm never eating it again,
and
I've eaten it consistently. The cold turkey approach tends to backfire, but
it does. You're right.
Something to consider. Be intentional about.
The FDA also talked about a new Alzheimer's drug made by Eli Lilly that says, and I'm going to quote here, has been shown in trials to modestly slow a decline in memory and thinking abilities. And, you know, Alzheimer's is one of those diseases that has no cure. Any thoughts on this new drug? And
yeah, I mean, there's been several that have hit the market recently that they're pretty disappointing. They're not the answer, right? It's
a Band-Aid.
We need something better. And, you know, Alzheimer's is so debilitating and probably not one disease course. I think that's why it's really hard to find a magic bullet here, because there's probably multiple ways to get there, or what happens or what triggers. And when they say modest, it's pretty modest.
Like really
and there's
small.
There's some controversy about whether it will even get coverage, you know, from like Medicare or Medicaid kinds of things.
The FDA, when it takes into account drugs and excuse me, that what their intended use is, how much do they consider the side effects on these drugs? And I have, you know, I take a couple of different medications. One is for restless legs, but there are definite side effects. The other is for my thyroid. I have a thyroid issues, and I just think, okay, for now, it's more important that I treat these two problems than whatever the side effects may be, short of, you know, killing me. But with almost maybe all drugs, there is a side effect.
Absolutely. Interesting. Well, I don't want to bring up that can of worms, but there are side effects associated with any medical intervention, right? Mm-hmm. And so you get into a balance of benefits versus risks. And, you know, there's some drugs that the risk profile just by far outweighs anything you're going to get good out of them. And sometimes the benefit is more for a certain subclass of disease or something, you know, so you have to kind of really weigh carefully. And that's what your doctor's for, is to talk through, well, you know, here's what we're dealing with. Here's the spectrum of what this could mean. Let's look at, and for some people, they respond more poorly than somebody.
That's true. Everybody's different.
Somebody else, right? Yeah. And so you say, well, you're just not going to tolerate that medication. You have to look for something else. But that's why they call it practicing medicine, right? It's a science with so many variables that it's really, really very intricate and delicate.
First of all, I will say this. I take a medicine for restless legs. I almost am to the point in my life where I don't care what the side effects are, because I cannot sleep if I don't take this medication an hour before I go to bed. I just, my restless legs at night are so severe. It will wait. I can't. It's so frustrating.
Well, and then you have the effects of not sleeping on top of everything
else, right?
So it's hard to make a blanket statement about any of that. And so are there medications on the market that can have difficult complications associated with them? Yeah. Are there some that have a really narrow band in which you can use them, right? You have to use the exact right dose, or it's not going to be a good, you know, good. Yeah, absolutely. That's why good, competent medical care is really an important part of all this.
I had a really interesting conversation off the air with Mary Ann Hamilton yesterday. She's the one that won Miss Senior Universe and has gone through breast cancer. She said there was a point in her life after, or maybe during, menopause where she elected to take certain hormones, and I don't know if it was estrogen or whatever it was, but she felt like the benefit of these were worth the risk, because, you know, and maybe as guys we don't understand this, but she said it does things inside of you that for women in menopause that we don't even understand. And she said, I was literally not myself. I was going through all these things. And she decided, and so I asked her this question. I said, all right, you took the estrogen or whatever it was. You did get breast cancer years later. Would you go back now and not take that estrogen? And she said, actually, I would still take it. Even though I had cancer and I had to go through all that, I would still go back and I would take it, because I wasn't me anymore. I felt so off, so messed up, that I had to have these drugs. Yeah. Interesting case, right?
Yeah, well, and it highlights some parts of medicine that I think are really important. We have not everybody's going to make the same choice given the same variables, right? And we had this idea of medical autonomy and the ability to self-determine your course of care is really important in the structure of medical ethics and stuff in that realm. And so unfortunately, we tend sometimes to want to impose our version of medical, you know, reality onto others.
Yeah.
Sometimes that's appropriate, but sometimes it's not. And this idea that you can choose to not take a medication that will save you if that's something that you choose not to do, right? It's always been that. You know, the classic case we always had to work through in our medical ethics class in medical school is that there's a patient that needs a transfusion, but they're refusing it. Do you force them to take the transfusion? The answer is no. They have the right to make that decision. But man, people struggle with it, right? Your doctor, you're supposed to be saving people's lives.
Yeah, sure. I mean, it's in the whole Hippocratic Oath, yeah, right? You know,
they can't choose that. Yes, they can. You can choose that, right? You can choose not to take the course of chemotherapy. That's a legitimate right.
I know people who have too,
right? Yeah. So, but then it gets into other complicated issues, and then you start to say, well, I think we don't have good answers for some areas, right? So,
yeah, that's a good point.
Don't mistake me for a libertarian, but as far as just whatever goes, you know, because sometimes you need to make sure people understand the consequences of what they're doing. And I think if they do, then that's different.
That brings up the whole DNR argument. You know, do not resuscitate. My wife is to the point, now she is not sickly. I'm not starting any rumors here, but she said if it gets to the point in my life where I'm dying and you have to perform heroic measures to bring me back, she said, don't.
Yeah.
And I'm like, but honey, you know, how can I let you go? And it's even in our society now, you actually have to have the piece of paper with your signature on it, right? To get a DNR. And because in our case, if my wife gets to that point, I don't want to let her go, but she's ready to go. It's a weird thing, man.
and difficult, right?
Yeah.
We do poorly in our country with end of life issues.
Yeah.
We really do. Something like 30% of the healthcare dollar goes into the last 2 weeks of life because we're trying to save people that, you know, probably want to go or they're really towards the end and we need to have better discussions around how do you make those decisions known, and how do you as family honor that? You know, the classic story is the long lost son that had a fight with dad, you know, 20 years ago, and now he feels bad, he wants to make up, but so he comes in and says you got to do whatever you can to save him, but you know, it's too late to do that. You know, those are the kinds of things you need to do now, not then, you know.
About a month ago, I wrote a story about it on our website, 890kdxu.com, but the guy had a DNR, but it had never been processed. Like, I think it was still sitting on his personal care physician, his family doctor's desk, and never been processed. And so when he had a heart attack or something, they performed life-saving, you know, efforts on him and brought him back to life. And now he's okay-ish. And he's like, I was ready to go. But they didn't get the word. They saved my life. And now I'm sitting here, you know, my wife has been gone for a few years. So I'm ready to go see her again. And yet here he sits. Mm. So it's an interesting case because he's like, I went through the process to let them know, but they never got word.
And now he's still here. So still was he mad that they saved him?
A little bit.
Yeah. Was he?
A little bit.
So that's, You hear the same story, but then they say, well, I'm actually glad they saved me, right?
Yeah. So he was kind of bold. He's like, you know, I'm happy to still be here with my grandkids and stuff and right. see them. But my wife's been gone a while. I would have been very happy to go yeah. see her in the next life or whatever, you know. So interesting in talking with him. I actually had a couple of people reach out to me and wanted to write stories in bigger publications. The LA Times lady called me and stuff. And I said, I got what I could out of him because I was a friend. He doesn't want it to be a national thing. But it's a very fascinating case because he's like, I should be dead is what he says. So, interesting stuff.
You know, we want to talk in absolutes sometimes, and sometimes there aren't absolutes. Sometimes we need to allow people to make that decision for themselves. So.
What was that number you gave me a few months ago? There's an actual number of the value of a human life and how much.
Yeah.
I sometimes think back on that. It wasn't 50 something thousand.
Yeah. That's probably a few years old. I'm sure
pre inflation.
Now, but,
yeah.
But yeah, the idea they call it what do they call it? It'll come back to me, but it's the value of a years of productive life that you can extend somebody's life with an intervention, a medication, a vaccination. So it's a way of quantifying the benefit and whether or not it's worth the money that you put into it, right? And so, and you know, $50,000, even a $50,000 number for a year is a big number, right? Yeah. And so I'm sure it's gone up since then. So you start to say, well, you know, so this medication costs this much money. The new medication costs, you know, five times as much. How many years of productive life lost are you going to have to improve the course of that treatment in order to justify that more expensive medication? And sometimes I'm not sure that's the best metric we should use for some of this.
Yeah.
But in a lot of times that's how they quantify whether or not, you know, insurance will cover it, whether or not, you know, it makes it to market, those kind of things. So
it's kind of sad. What is the value of human life? Some would say priceless.
Yeah.
No matter the cost. And apparently the medical industry doesn't necessarily feel that way.
Well, and at what point is it not
yeah.
worth that, right? I think we all have a different line there.
You're right.
And having those conversations, and how do you decide that societally to say, well, we can't afford endless health care for everybody.
Sure.
Where are those lines? And I don't know. I think we've struggled mightily.
We start thinking about people in a coma and how much does it cost to keep someone in a coma alive for a month, 6 months,
right.
a year, multiple years. You know, what if they don't wake up and you're still, you know, ethical questions. Maybe you and I aren't completely qualified to answer
yeah,
those.
We're not the ones for that. They pay people a lot of money to do that stuff. But boy, you know, on a political hot potato, start talking about it, you know. So that's why I'm not.
That's why we're not going to. Let's check weather instead. We're with Dr. Blodgett on the Andy Griffin Show.
All the latest news, weather, traffic, and sports, just like you like them. You're waking up with the Andy Griffin Show on News Radio 890, 92.5 KDXU, Southern Utah's news talk leader.
Welcome back. I'm Andy. Dr. Blodgett is here first Wednesday of the month. Dr. Blodgett, you got any plans for the 4th? You doing anything exciting?
It's mostly family and.
Yeah? Get a barbecue?
Yeah, probably have some watermelon.
Nice. Watermelon is. You talked about the egg being the perfect food, right? Watermelon's up there.
Yeah, it's up there, yeah.
Yeah, it's a pretty good one.
It's the perfect food on a hot day, right?
That's true. And they've even bioengineered seeds out of a lot of them nowadays, too.
Yeah,
so you don't have
maybe
too many
so.
Seeds.
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't know how I feel about bioengineering, but I'm not totally against it. I mean, you see pictures of, like, the tomato from 1912 and a tomato from 2024, and you're like, I'm glad they bioengineered that because they were kind of ugly and pathetic back then.
Well, so. Bioengineering's been going on since the history of the world, right?
Yeah.
You say, cow has a characteristic I want, so
yeah.
I'm going to see if I can't get more of it, you know.
It's true. I thought we could talk maybe just a couple of minutes, because it is unbelievably hot, about some of the things that we need to know when it comes to heat. There's a website that talks about some of the myths about heat, you know, heat problems, heat stroke, but I don't know that we want to go myths necessarily, but maybe just talk about some of these things. For instance, one of the thoughts is the elderly are the only ones at risk for heat stroke, but that's not true. Everyone's at risk.
Yeah, right? You know, it's all about body temperature, right? So if your body gets to a place where it's above 104 degrees in your core temperature, you think about kids, that's when they start having seizures and stuff, if they have a fever that high. But if your body temperature is high and you've lost the ability to compensate through heating or you know, through sweating or whatever it is, you know, that would help you in that situation, that starts to interfere with normal metabolic processes, and it's definitely not
wow, dude. I remember this was weird to me, and I didn't remember much from when I had sepsis and was in the hospital for a week, because I was medicated and I was pretty messed up. But one of the things I had when I first went in, I had a very high fever. I don't remember what it was, but it was very high fever, and they took my socks off and they took the blanket away from me. Mm-hmm. And here I am freezing because, right. You know, I'm shivering, you know, because I know it's a weird that I would be freezing, but I was freezing even though I had a fever, and I begged him for the blanket back. Can I please have my sock? Can I please have the blanket back? And my wife went to get the blanket and they're like, no, 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 you can't have that. And my wife's like, why? And I was like, why? And they said, well, we've got to break the fever.
Yeah.
And I was.
Got to get that core temperature down. You know, when you think about the purpose of a fever, that's to help fight off bugs. Yeah. You know, the bacteria and viruses don't do well in the heat either. And so that's what it's all about, is you're trying to, you know, kill that off. So when you induce that kind of heat situation by the external environment you're in and the sun, so the sun's making, you know, you sweat, you don't have enough fluids, yeah, you're sort of not sweating, so you can't cool down. And that core temperature gets up too high, then you can be in trouble. That's not to say, though, that there aren't certain groups that really need to be very, very careful, that are a little bit higher risk. And maybe that's where this, if you want to call it a myth, comes from. It's not a myth to say, look, if you're elderly, be extra careful about this. Mowing the lawn at noon, St. George.
Not a bad idea. No. Yeah. No. Try 6 a.m. That would now your neighbors won't like you, but you won't probably die from heat.
But you gotta do it at something. You can't be out in 110 degrees in the sun and think that's going to go well.
So. Now, I have experienced a couple of different times in my life heat exhaustion, which is, I guess, kind of right before heat stroke.
Right.
And it one of the things it talks about is a recovery from heat exhaustion. It takes a lot out of you. You can't just, you know, okay, I'm going to cool down. I'm good now. You are better, yes, but it takes a lot out of you. You address that a little.
Well, you got to restore the fluids. Mm-hmm. You got to make sure you have your body temperature back down. You're kind of normalized, that the effects of that are kind of not lingering with you. So, you know, you look for a little bit of confusion, dizziness, stuff like that kind of starts into that exhaustion. And then once you get into the heat stroke itself, that's, you know, mental status changes. You even get it to a place where you can't sweat anymore.
Yeah, I was going to say, that seems so counterintuitive. You stop sweating, basically, if you have heat stroke.
Yeah, well, and that's it. That's when you're in real trouble, right? So when you're sweating, you're still, and you're hot, and you know you're hot, and you think, man, I got to get, you know, something different going on. That's the warning signs. And then once you hit the heat stroke range, though, where your skin is clammy but not sweating, and you notice that they're talking, there is jumbled and nonsense, they can't really track very well.
Heat stroke, so it's like a stroke.
Yeah, you gotta start looking for a way to get them out of the heat and get them hydrated, and you know, we there's kind of a, what about minerals, stuff like that? Is Gatorade better than just water?
Right.
Most people, you're not going to have a big enough change in their status of salt levels or magnesium or whatever to be a problem, because we're well nourished in our society. But getting pounding that water down, and if you have Gatorade, that's fine too, but sometimes the sugar can cause complications. So lots of water, get them into a cool place, let them start to cool down.
And I would add, never underestimate the power of shade.
Yeah. Yes.
I mean, I know it sounds stupid, and maybe it's me rationalizing where I live, but I promise you, for me personally, to be out of the direct sunlight and into shade, even though it's really all, pretty much as hot, yeah, it makes a difference.
Yeah, well, it's 10, 15, 20 degrees yeah, cooler. And if there's a breeze somewhere, you can get a breeze going. That really helps with the evaporation process, yeah, and cooling things down.
Okay, acclimation, or acclimatization, as it says on here. How real is that? I swear to you, and maybe it's not true. I believe it is true, but I will go somewhere, having lived in St. George now for 30 years, I will go somewhere that's a little bit cooler, and it might be, you know, in the 60s there, and I'm cold, and they're making fun of me because I'm cold, but I don't, is it true there's a possibility that our blood thins out a little, or we get acclimatized to the warmer temperatures, and so cold, moderate feels cold to us, and to them maybe moderate feels warm to them. Is that, do you think that's true?
What does the myth say? I don't want to contradict you.
Acclimatization can help your body better cope with heat, but it does not completely eliminate the risk.
Right. Okay. So the answer is yes, there is some. And I'll give you some evidence of that.
Okay. I like evidence.
In the winter, I swear my family wants the thermostat to be set at 85 degrees, right? Yeah. And in the summer, they want it set at about 68, right? Yeah. And I've never understood that, right?
Yeah.
And so, and the answer is this core temperature set point and what you perceive as being comfortable, mm-hmm, kind of shifts with the seasons. It's this idea of acclimatization. So here in St. George, maybe you can handle a little bit warmer, but the price you pay is if you go suddenly from that to someplace that's cooler. I remember I had a cousin who was the same way. He'd come up to our place. So he'd be in St. George. He'd come up to Cedar, just Cedar, right? I mean, it's only 10 degrees cooler. He's like, gosh, it's kind of cold here. And I'm like, are you kidding me?
it's
95 degrees. So it is a reality. But the article is correct that that's not going to protect you if it's, you know, 120 degrees, something like that.
I thought this was fascinating. Alcohol and the effects of keeping you cool. In the article, they talk about how alcohol can actually increase the risk of heat stroke because it affects your body's ability to regulate temperature and leads to dehydration.
Yeah.
We've talked about alcohol many times, but how about alcohol versus hot weather?
So this is how we get magical thinking to justify whatever we want to do, right? So in the winter, we say, people say, oh, alcohol is going to make me warm, yeah, right? Yeah, and then in the summer, we say, oh, alcohol is going to make me cold. And the reality is, it doesn't do either. It's the opposite. And it makes you less able to regulate your temperature and have control over that. So so somebody that's drinking alcohol and they get in cold weather, they're more likely to have hypothermia and die. And people that have a lot of alcohol on board are more likely to heat up, have heat stroke, and have problems that way. So, yeah, no, that's definitely a myth to avoid.
A myth, okay. How about ice baths? It talks about ice baths for a minute and rapid cooling. It's kind of a fad now for athletes. They get done their game, they go get an ice bath, and it cools them down very quickly. Is there a danger in that?
It's the trend. It must be true, right?
Well, you and I both know that just because it's the trend doesn't mean it's true.
So we know ice and ice. So there's two different aspects of this. There's an anti-inflammatory component.
Sure.
So, you used to see guys like Stockton go back and they'd slap the ice on right after a game. And that they'd contributed longevity.
Pitchers in baseball always put it on their shoulder or whatever.
That definitely has a thing part of the ice bath phenomenon is they want to trigger the fight or flight response and increase black or brown fat energy production, so it keeps you thinner. And there's all of this complex metabolic reasoning behind it. I don't know that using it for trying to, it definitely helps cool down, and if somebody is in heat stroke, that might be something they use in a medical setting, but I think you have to be really careful with the rapid swing there, right? I think that can cause trouble.
So. Yeah, that's pretty much what the article said, so okay. You're right on the money on that one. Yeah.
You quiz me, and I wonder.
So. Oh, you almost always nail it right on the nose, so that's awesome. So tomorrow I am going to be one of the judges in the St. George Star Search competition.
Okay. Well, that sounds
it's
good.
10:30 to 12:30 tomorrow. So it'll only be probably in the high 90s during that time. It probably won't get over 100 till after 12 or after 1. But somebody said you should buy one of those fans that has a little water bottle connected to it. Turn the fan on, you spray the water, it mists the water, and it'll keep you cool. And that got me to thinking, well, do fans help? Is that something that is, I mean, it makes you feel a little better for a minute. But is it?
So sweating, the whole purpose behind sweating is to have evaporation pull heat with it. So
right.
It takes
cool
heat
you down.
To transition water from liquid to vapor, right? And that's
sure.
That's your basic chemistry class or physics. And because you're aiding that process, I think it does help. It's probably more of a comfort issue than a body core issue, if that makes sense. So if you're still out, you know, you see people that put the cooling bands around the neck too, and I think that makes you feel more comfortable too. But if you're in a situation where it's hot enough that you're going to heat your core up, I don't know that that's going to be enough.
Yeah, help a whole lot. Okay. In Cedar City, I lived in Cedar City for 1 year before moving to Washington County, and we had just a swamp cooler in our house, not an air conditioner. And there were, on the hottest days, didn't really help a whole ton unless you went and stood directly underneath it. Is that still pretty much a trend in Cedar, or have they all?
Swamp coolers are great. They'll take 20 degrees off. Problem is, if it's 110, then that's still 90, right?
Yeah,
so
hot.
So there are a few days every year where the swamp cooler isn't quite enough, and you just have to say, well, I'm going to. The savings and the convenience are good enough that I'm not going to do, because, you know, air conditioning, really expensive.
It is.
Swamp coolers, really cheap. So,
good point. All right, let's get a quick commercial break in, back with Dr. Blodgett, more with him and some of your questions after this.
Wake up with the news and information you can trust. This is the Andy Griffin Show on News Radio 890, 92.5 KDXU, Southern Utah's News Talk leader.
He is the health professional here, the health officer in 5 counties, Southern Utah, including Washington County and Iron County. He lives in Iron County, went to Cedar High School. His name is Dr. David Blodgett. Dr. Blodgett is here. If you have a question for him, give me a call, 673-5890. Dr. Blodgett, you got a couple things to bring up on the calendar?
Well, you shouldn't. If you tell people I'm from Cedar, that might lessen my credibility.
Let me go here then. Dr. David Blodgett was chief resident at Johns Hopkins University. We'll leave the Cedar part out.
That's too kind. No, I'm proud to be from Cedar. I just know that I hearken back to the days when it was only Cedar and Dixie, right?
That was quite the rivalry.
So the rivalry was intense.
My buddy who was an assistant coach, longtime assistant coach at Cedar High, called us the something sorghum lappers from St. George, and I don't know what we called them up there, but there was quite a rivalry, Dixie and Cedar, for quite some time.
Once Pine View came along, it kind of disrupted the
whole thing. You got Pine View, and then you got Snow Canyon, and then you got Desert Hills, and you got Crimson Cliffs, and up in Cedar you got Canyon View, and that became kind of the new rival for Cedar. But
but it's not like the old days.
No.
Yeah, but they were, rivalries are a fun part of the whole process.
Yeah.
There are, along with this temperature theme, mm-hmm. there are some things to remember. One is this idea that being outside and heating up can be a problem. Make sure you hydrate adequately. They recommend 2 glasses of water for every half hour that you're out in over 100 degree temperature.
Okay.
Also, now is the time for picnics, for being out, for camping, for, you know, so keeping cold foods cold becomes an issue of priority that we deal with quite a bit. So we, part of our job is we track illnesses, and some of those get reported to us. So salmonella and stuff like that, that ends up on our radar screen. And this is the time of year for a lot of those, because you go out, things are get a little warmer than they should for a little longer than they should.
Yeah.
And you end up, you know, with some of that. So just a reminder, if your food is above 40 degrees for more than 4 hours, there could be a problem there. So
I always wanted to ask this: if I have a food that maybe got contaminated that way, but I reheat it at a very high temperature, will that kill whatever bugs?
Yeah. So heating is a good way to kill it. The only exception to that is if you're unlucky enough to have, it's called heat-stable toxins.
Ooh,
right? So
I don't like
so
that.
So certain species of E. coli can secrete these, you know, heat-stable toxins that will then still be in the food even if you heat them up. So one of the ways you can tell if that's what you have is it's very fast-acting. So most of the time when you get food poisoning, it's 2, 3, 4 days later. So okay. When we try and track down where did you get sick from, it's really hard because people
sure.
actually don't remember.
Well, I ate at such and such last
yeah.
night.
Well,
yeah,
so they always remember the place they ate that day, but yeah. that's not where it was. It was 2, 3 days before.
Okay.
But these heat-stable toxins, that's 6, 8 hours later, you're in trouble, right? And so they're much, it's a much different game there. And so we always have to try and kind of tease out what it might be there, but anyway, just do the best you can to keep that food cold.
And I will throw in, as long as we're talking health and safety, swimming pools,
right,
you know, little kids around pools, you know, keep your cover closed and locked if you can, and if you don't have a cover, a fence around it is certainly appropriate.
Yeah, it's among the worst tragedies, right? And we always talk this time of year about not leaving kids in cars, because we always have that story that hits about now. And just be really careful not to have pets, kids locked in a car that heats up to, boy, about 160 degrees or something like that by the time you're
cooking them. Terrible.
When the car's not on.
All right. Dr. Blodgett, thanks for coming today. It's always good to talk to you.
Great to be here. Thank you, Andy.
We appreciate it. If you have you have any needs or concerns with the Public Health Department, SWUHealth.gov now, right?
Yeah, we've switched over to .gov.
.gov. So good to talk to you today.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Off tomorrow, off Friday. So we'll be back on Monday. And, hey, I wanted to remind you real quick, 10 seconds here. Patriotic program, that is tomorrow night, 7 o'clock at the LDS Stake Center, just east of the historic St. George Temple. I'll be narrating. It's a night of music saluting our country.